And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, here and excited to be with you for another edition. And today we have a very interesting guest, Dr. David M. Brady, and he's going to be talking about fibromyalgia, his new book, The FibroFix, The FibroFix Summit, and how you can get information for you and your loved ones to stay healthy. And, of course, you can always reach myself and Dr. Kamai at our respective websites. That's drznaturally.com and naturalnurse.com for more information. So, onward with the program as we introduce Dr. David M. Brady, who has over 25 years of experience as an integrative practitioner and academician. He's first started as a chiropractor, and then he continued his education as a licensed naturopathic physician in Connecticut and Vermont, and a board-certified clinical nutritionist. He's a prolific author of medical papers and research articles on fibromyalgia and many other topics, autoimmune disease as well, and has dedicated a large part of his professional career in helping people recover from this mysterious disorder. He's the Vice Provost for the Division of Health Sciences and the Director of Human Nutrition Institute, as well as a professor at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. He also has a private practice, Whole Body Medicine, in Fairfield, Connecticut, and is CMO for Designs for Health and Diagnostic Solutions Lab. Dr. Brady teaches with an encyclopedic knowledge of natural medicine, and we love hearing him as he appears on many speaking panels of the largest and most prestigious conferences in the field. He's a highly dedicated champion and advocate for patients suffering from fibromyalgia diagnosis and the author of the book that we're going to be featuring today, The FibroFix by Rodale. And we have Dr. Brady right here with us. Dr. Brady, are you there?
I am, Dr. Z. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again, my friend.
Yeah, great. Nice to have you. And, you know, this is a very interesting subject, this fibromyalgia and just chronic pain itself. I know with your background as both a chiropractor and then a naturopathic physician and then studying this particular field of integrative medicine, you have a unique sort of lens on understanding chronic pain and be able to differentiate it from so many other types of things which masquerades as pain, as pain is basically just a symptom and not really a cause. So let's start with your definition of fibromyalgia.
Oh, well, thanks, Dr. Z. And, you know, you're right. I think over 25 years of having sort of a multidisciplinary perspective and training from, you know, starting off first as a physical medicine trained provider when with chiropractic, but then going on for many, many years and studying clinical nutrition, botanical medicine, and then naturopathic and functional medicine. So, you know, being able to bring in that sort of metabolic side of the equation and even the psychological part of this very complex disorder we call fibromyalgia, I think has been, you know, useful for me to try to put the pieces together, because I certainly was not trained in my primary training or even my secondary training in school to be able to deal with these patients that have these global pain and fatigue disorders. What I was told about fibromyalgia in my formal training was little. What I was told, the little I was told, was generally incorrect, and I'm not alone. And I would say that that's the case for people getting out of medical school today. It's just not really covered well enough. Physicians are confused. Patients are confused. But, you know, the definition of fibromyalgia is not my definition. It's the definition that's created by the American College of Rheumatology, and they've published several different diagnostic criteria, the most recent being in 2010, and then it was modified in 2011. But the basic criteria are pretty simple, actually, and that is the patient has to basically have a perception of pain or achiness all over the body, and it cannot be in one place or a couple of places. It has to literally be everywhere. So they perceive achiness above the waist, below the waist, left side, right side, along the midline of the body, out in the periphery. And they generally have some symptoms and other conditions that go along with that body-wide achiness, and that includes persistent fatigue, but common complaints of some level of at least mild depression, anxiety, unrefreshed sleep. So they may sleep 12, 14 hours, but they get up feeling like they never slept and they're not restored. And generally, there's a lot of sort of correlating or concomitant, as we call it, vague intestinal problems. So things like gas and bloating, even diarrhea or constipation, cramping in the gut, things that would otherwise often be diagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. And these patients are almost universally female. They generally have a strong correlation with a history of long-term stress, even in early life, in particular, stress, trauma, abuse, witnessing some horrible event. We can talk more about some of those things, but these are things very, very common to the fibromyalgic's history. And the thing, Dr. Z, that has to be done is you have to essentially rule out all other potential causes for the patient's symptoms and issues. So you have to rule out a lot of medical conditions, a lot of metabolic and functional conditions, a lot of musculoskeletal or structural conditions. And quite frankly, I find that that's very rarely done before someone is just given a diagnosis or a label of fibromyalgia and sent on their way with an antidepressant drug or an anti-epileptic, recycled anti-epileptic drug.
But there are tests for fibromyalgia. Am I wrong? Or are you basically saying that when you rule out everything but you're still perplexed as to the cause, then it's kind of labeled as fibromyalgia?
From a laboratory perspective, there are no tests for fibromyalgia. There are a lot of tests that we do to rule out other medical conditions, and there are a lot of metabolic things that we do from a testing standpoint to look at aspects of physiology and metabolism that are common among fibromyalgia patients, but there is no box that you check on a lab requisition as a physician that's a fibromyalgia factor that comes back positive or negative or yes or no. That does not exist. There's well-defined types of sleep dysfunction that occur in true classic fibromyalgia patients. So if you put people in sleep labs, you can usually find, if they're truly a classic fibromyalgia patient, what we call alpha wave intrusion in sleep. But once again, that in and of itself is not diagnostic of fibromyalgia. It's just very common in fibromyalgia. So it is really a diagnosis of exclusion. And to doctors, that means we basically rule everything else out and then see, do the pieces fit? So all of those different things that I told you need to be included really need to be there, or we really start lending toward finding some other reason why the patient inappropriately got given a label of fibromyalgia. And generally, they do certainly have something real wrong with them. We're not suggesting if they don't have fibromyalgia that they don't have anything or they're making it up. Not at all. It's just kind of lazy diagnosis, Dr. Z, where the doctors aren't really quite prepared for these patients. They often find them challenging, therefore they find them frustrating. They're not sure what to do about them, so they generally just shuttle them off on another specialist and send them on their way.
Now, I know sometimes they're misdiagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome. Is there a big difference between the two syndromes, Dr. Brady?
Yeah, this is a common confusion point, and it's not as much anymore, but, back in the day, people talked about fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome as sort of one in the same or sister disorders. You'll see things written like fibromyalgia / chronic fatigue syndrome, and they are not the same thing. They're absolutely not the same thing. It is true that people that truly have classic fibromyalgia, this pain processing sensory, disorder, almost 100% of them have ongoing persistent fatigue. So they have fatigue on a chronic basis, but they don't have chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue syndrome is really a syndrome where their pervasive symptom is fatigue. And many of these patients, if not most of these patients, do not have global achiness or pain. They don't necessarily have anxiety and depression and IBS. They don't have those things. Quite frequently, they have just significant, persistent, unrelenting fatigue. Often it's secondary to having some sort of viral episode, almost like a flu kind of event, and then they never quite regain their vitality back, and that's sometimes called chronic fatigue and immune deficiency syndrome. But they are very, very different things, and they should not be grouped together. And there's a big movement to get physicians educated to not do that, but it still happens all the time. If you go on the internet now and search fibromyalgia, half the stuff will say fibromyalgia/chronic fatigue syndrome and vice versa, and it's just, it's not appropriate, but it's common.
Yeah, interesting. So when you're working up a patient that you think has fibromyalgia, you're reviewing a lot of labs that are done. Now, what typically do mainstream doctors do as a laboratory, and then contrast that with sort of what you would do?
Well, it's a good question. There's not a stock answer because, quite honestly, in my 25 years or so dealing with literally thousands of patients who had the label or the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, many of whom turned out to have other things, the workups that were done on them by, you know, family physicians, internal medicine doctors, and even in some cases rheumatologists, before they were given a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, was very little. I've had patients come in with diagnosis of fibromyalgia from their family physician when they've had virtually no lab work done. They didn't have things ruled out like anemia, like blood sugar abnormalities, like, you know, some kind of organic, you know, organ dysfunction in the body. They didn't have, you know, the basics ruled out that might explain why the patient's fatigued, why the patient may actually be achy, why they may have some of these other conditions, like a lot of gut symptoms. But sometimes they do. They have, you know, basic blood chemistry panels, a complete blood count, maybe a thyroid panel, which is all good stuff and absolutely should be done. Mm. Generally, often, they should get inflammatory markers done, you know, C-reactive protein, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or what we call SED rates, to rule out overtly inflammatory conditions such as autoimmune arthritides and the like. But sometimes it's done. Oftentimes, unfortunately, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The functional medicine doctor, however, will do all of that, but will also look more into more granular sort of detailed things about the person's unique physiology and their biochemistry, such as how do their cells make energy, because if your cells aren't making energy very well at the level of the mitochondria, these little energy factories in the cell, you'll certainly be tired. You will be ATP or energy deficient, so your brain doesn't work very well, so you have the so-called fibrofog or cognitive inability to think straight and to concentrate. But also, you can tend to get achiness in the muscles because you're generally in what we call anaerobic metabolism, and you're producing a lot of acidic waste products in the muscles as part of your metabolism. Just like if you go out and exert yourself and do some sort of exercise you're not used to, you will be achy for a few days. If someone is stuck in that kind of metabolism all the time, then they're persistently achy all over the body. So there are reasons why you can have fatigue, achiness, cognitive issues related to energy or mitochondrial biochemistry issues, and we can find those things on specialized testing, which we call organic acid testing, and it's generally not done by conventionally trained sort of orthodox physicians, but it is by integrative, naturopathic, and functional medicine docs. The other thing we do is we look very closely at the adrenal glands and the thyroid gland, and we look beyond the standard tests that are done by a conventional doctor for thyroid. We're looking for more subtle issues related to thyroid, because if the thyroid is slow and underperforming, even if it's not overtly abnormal, but if it's suboptimal, in many patients it can cause profound fatigue, achiness, you know, thyroid myalgia or ache in the muscle related to low thyroid is a well-reported symptom in the medical literature, but it's often forgotten by physicians. It'll also slow your bowels, making you constipated, giving you vague intestinal symptoms. It can make you slow of thought. So thyroid is a big issue, as is adrenal function. Adrenal function dances with the thyroid function, so you have to look at those in tandem. So looking at all of those things, we can kind of start ruling out other things that might have gotten someone a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. And the final thing, Dr. Z, is we need to put our hands on the patient, and particularly those of us trained in physical medicine are looking to see, are there actual changes in the muscles themselves? Are they tight? Is there trigger points, something we call myofascial pain syndrome? Are there areas of true structural problems, orthopedic and muscular or tendinous or fascial problems that are causing the patient's pain and getting them an erroneous diagnosis of fibromyalgia? And if that's the case, we need to treat them from a structural or a physical or a hands-on perspective, because true classic fibromyalgia is not a muscle disorder at all. So treatments directed at the muscles and the soft tissues, such as massage and in some cases acupuncture, chiropractic, physical therapy, oftentimes they fail because the problem in classic fibromyalgia is actually central in the brain and the central nervous system. It's really not in the muscles. So you're treating the patient where they perceive the problem to be, but not where the problem actually is, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, so basically, just to reiterate, you're saying that in fibromyalgia, they may not have thyroid problems, and you need to kind of rule those things out, and it's not a specific localized myofascial issue, tight muscles and things like that. It's not a localized sleep disorder. So basically you're saying that, you know, the localization of these signs and symptoms aren't really there, but it's yet a global problem, and they could actually have some of these things. And it basically deals with a pain processing disorder in the central nervous system.
Right, exactly. So if the problem is there, that's where the treatment has to be centered. So a lot of people do have, you know, structural muscle, you know, kind of issues, and they get a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, it's not right. It's myofascial pain syndrome. It's something structural that needs to be addressed. And then there are those people, honestly, who can have both, right? They can have multiple problems. I mean, we always have to remember as doctors that the patient has the right to more than one disorder at any given time. So
that's right. Yeah,
sometimes
true.
There's real complicated patients that have a multitude of things going on. But if the problem really is a central pain processing disorder, we have to really treat it there. We have to look at their different neurotransmitter levels. We have to really examine their previous life experiences and their stress physiology. And we have to intervene with other types of things. And we will often use precursors, you know, different amino acids and different botanicals or herbals, and even different neurotransmitters directly, like GABA, for instance. We'll use serotonin precursors like 5-hydroxytryptophan. We'll use melatonin to help drive people into deeper, refreshed sleep. Based on their scenario, we can use other calming, adaptogenic botanicals that are somewhat sedating and calming to the nervous system. So we can attack it on the biochemical side, but generally you also have to deal with it from the psychological and the stress, you know, mitigation and retraining your body how to deal with its environment. So we use cognitive behavioral therapies quite frequently. So things from biofeedback, heart rate variability, but even things that the patient can do on their own, meditation, yoga, tai chi, qigong, prayer, guided imagery, progressive relaxation. I cover a lot of these things in my book. Motion. We need to get the person back into movement, and they can't go out and do a bunch of exertional classic exercise in their state until they're more recovered, but they really do need to start moving again. And oftentimes they're afraid to start moving again because they don't want to exacerbate or make themselves worse. So the book does a lot of, from the ground up, getting the person moving again and attaining more flexibility and range of motion in very safe ways while we're treating the biochemical side of the equation. And sometimes they actually need some level of counseling as well if they really have a significant psychological trauma or abuse or something like that in the history. Not everyone does, but quite frequently people do. And by, you know, working this all together in a very organized, systematic way, we generally get very good results with people progressing toward recovery.
Hmm. Let's go back to some points that you brought up there, which were very fascinating, including the neurotransmitter issues there. So just let's define neurotransmitters for the audience that perhaps that flew over their head.
They're chemicals that are produced in the body.
Yeah.
Are used by the nervous system and the brain to send messages. And there are neurotransmitters like, for instance, serotonin and GABA, which are related to sort of calming the brain, calming the person, making you feel okay, making you feel safe, making you feel less perception to pain, less alarmed. Mm-hmm. And there are other neurotransmitters that are sort of the up neurotransmitters, right, that are very sort of excitatory. Things like the catecholamines, like epinephrine, norepinephrine, and others as well that can make the body, you know, more sort of on edge, if you will. So we need to look at the balance of these things because they affect how we react to stressors, how we react to any kind of sensory information, how we perceive pain or not pain, how likely we are to go into all the cycles of sleep, which is very important. So if those are out of balance, we need to try to move those into balance, both by intervening chemically, and that could be in the form of drugs, or it can be in the form of herbals, botanicals, precursors. And in the book, I talk about all those options, including the different medications that are available and approved for fibromyalgia, the ones that are used in an off-label method, when they might be useful, when they are likely not to work, what the potential side effects or downsides are. But we also, you know, retrain the brain through these cognitive behavioral therapies and stress mitigating practices that I just talked about a little bit earlier.
Now, I thought that most people have, you know, okay neurotransmitters if they're eating a good diet and they have a lot of protein, because I guess a lot of these come from the different amino acids in the body. What could be going on if you're eating a lot of protein and then you do a test to show that you're very low in, for instance, glutamine, which is one of the most abundant amino acids in the body? Like, where is it going, and how could it be so low despite, I mean, the folks aren't vegans. You know, they're not like diehard vegans. They're eating protein. What do you think is going on as a naturopathic doctor?
Well, it's a very good question. First of all, a lot of people may think they're getting adequate protein, but they're not getting quality adequate protein, particularly with each meal. They're not getting protein at the right times of day. But that being said, assuming they are, there are different genetic, you know, uniquenesses in our biochemistry, and some people have aberrant genetics. They're called, you know, polymorphisms, where they have specific enzymes that are meant to take these amino acids, let's say, and produce a certain neurotransmitter, let's say taking the amino acid tryptophan in protein. It's got to get converted to 5-hydroxytryptophan, then it has to get hydroxylated to serotonin, you know, and then it has to get detoxified through the monoamine oxidase pathway. So these are a lot of enzymes that require specific nutritional cofactors. They require specific enzymes to be produced in the body, which is dictated by our genetics. And our genetics sometimes are not as robust as the average person. So there are people who are genetically susceptible to, let's say, low serotonin, and therefore depression, increased pain perception, sleep disruption, seasonal affective disorder. And we know where these gene loci are right now. We don't know all of them, but we certainly know some of them. And we can look for those things as well. I mean, we know people, for instance, who have methylation disorders have really a lot of problems in maintaining normal neurotransmitter levels. So some of that is going on genes. Some of it's vitamin mineral insufficiencies that make these enzymes work. Sometimes it's inadequate diet, but sometimes it's a lot of that plus the right environment, right? Because usually an outcome, a disease or not having a disease or a disorder, is not just genetics, it's not just environment, it's usually the dance between the two. So if someone, when they were very young, particularly a woman or a girl at that point, has been exposed very early in life when her nervous system was developing to lots of stress, lots of trauma, even feeling unsafe, you know, let's say an alcoholic raging father in the household or mother getting abused or maybe her getting abused or maybe just real loud sort of yelling environment. She never felt like she can live up to expectations. Nothing was good enough. Sort of those type of scenarios can create an aberrant response of the brain into the deepest emotional centers of the brain known as the limbic system, which can change the way the brain interprets any kind of information coming into the nervous system, and it can sort of over-amplify it and be hypersensitive to it because their nervous system is learning that, hey, I'm never safe, I'm always under threat, so it's always sort of waiting for the next shoe to drop, and it becomes almost hyper-perceptive, right? We call it hypervigilance syndrome, and you see this in things like post-traumatic stress disorder if someone's had battlefield experience or, you know, post-rape or something like that. But this is something that happens usually more at the micro-trauma level in a persistent way when this person's very young, and it just fundamentally changes the way the nervous system behaves, and we don't really understand exactly how and why it happens, but we do know it does happen. And when you get in these aberrant patterns, a lot of times you're sort of chewing up or using up certain neurotransmitters much more rapidly than someone who doesn't have this dysfunction would. Or you need a much higher level of a neurotransmitter to counteract these effects than the average person would. So it's a special circumstance. It's not just, you know, you're getting enough protein in your diet or not. It's much more complicated than that.
Well, that was a beautiful explanation of how we could, how these things can be almost wired into our existence.
Yeah, they can. And it's interesting, Dr. Z, in that, you know, young girls put in that same kind of scenario that I laid out for you, in a much higher prevalence, go on to develop things later in life like global pain and sensitivity syndromes like fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, all of these sort of, you know, irritable bladder, irritable bowel, all irritable everything, right? They're hypersensitive, where young boys, you know, put in an equally challenging situation like that, even overt abuse and the like, they generally do not. They can. It happens, but it's very rare that they go on to develop that. Instead, they more develop other compensations, things like easy to frustrate, acting out violently, being, you know, quick to anger, quick to fight, quick to be another abuser, basically. The same abuse they had inflicted on them, they will repeat it, where in women that's not nearly as common. So it seems in both scenarios the body remembers, the body adapts to the trauma, but there really is a gender difference. And I know that's sort of stereotyping, but and there are exceptions to it, but generally that's the rule. The female and the male brain react differently to these types of situations, and it also has to be a somewhat genetically susceptible person that is exposed to that, because we know fibromyalgia, for instance, runs genetically in families. And I don't mean it's hardwired genetically, but if you have, a mother who has fibromyalgia, you are more likely to develop it as a woman than someone whose mother did not. But you also have to have these other environmental factors and other things sort of in the picture as well.
Wow, amazing stuff. So again, if you're just joining us, we're interviewing Dr. David M. Brady, who has many, many years of experience, a quarter century of experience as an integrated practitioner.
Making me feel really old, Dr. C.
Hey, I started very young. Let's put it this way.
And he's the author of a fabulous book, The Fibrofix from Rodale, that's available now. And also, tell us a little bit about the Fibrofix Summit, Dr. Brady, that you're running.
Yeah, thank you. This is a really incredible event that's online. Anyone could register for it and participate in it and learn from it. It's called the Fibrofix Summit. You can just go to fibrofixsummit.com. So F-I-B-R-O-F-I-X.
And what is a summit, if I might ask? What is a summit, Dr. Brady?
A summit is, you know, the online summit movement has gotten pretty big in different topics where basically I, as the host, take people on a journey over a week to really learning everything that they can learn as a patient or someone who might be afflicted with a disorder like this, where I interview essentially about 35 experts around the world in fibromyalgia and in all the other disorders that are inappropriately or incorrectly diagnosed as fibromyalgia. So I have experts from some of the best academic centers in the world on things like irritable bowel syndrome and intestinal GI dysbiosis and how that relates to the diagnosis of fibromyalgia. I have adrenal and stress experts. I have fatigue experts. I have experts on anxiety and depression and sleep disorders, experts on classic fibromyalgia itself, experts on how to change your diet and use food as medicine, experts in botanical medicine. I have you and Dr. Cammie on the summit as experts as well, talking about all of the things in nature's, you know, sort of medicine chest that you can use to help in these disorders. And this summit runs from June 20th to the 27th. You can just register at fibrofixsummit.com. It's all free. People are given the option if they want to keep the content or download it or get it on a flash drive or to listen at their own pace and all. They can also pay a small fee and download it. That information's there, but you can attend it certainly entirely for free. Just go to the website and you'll see all the speakers and all the wonderful opportunities there are to attend the summit. So fibrofixsummit.com, and it's timed in to lead up to the release of the book, The Fibrofix. And the book is really a culmination of all of my years of experience and several years of writing to try to bring this story to the people. As you know, Dr. Z, I've written many, many medical publications in the peer-reviewed medical journals on fibromyalgia. I've written chapters in medical textbooks on fibromyalgia. So I've been doing a lot of writing and researching in my career and trying to educate my colleagues on this, but this book is really taking all of this information and the story to the people in a way that they can understand it, digest it, you know, and to help empower them to do things on their own to facilitate their own recovery, to be their best health advocate, and to also work with their health provider and physician in new things to look at. And you can learn more about the book and pre-order it at fibrofix.com. So if you just go to fibrofix, F-I-B-R-O-F-I-X.com, you can preview the book. There's links out to do a pre-purchase on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all the big vendors of your choice. It's 40% off the cover price now in a pre-release sale. And then you can, after you purchase it at any of those book sites, you can come back and validate your purchase on the Fibrofix, on fibrofix.com, and it unlocks all kinds of bonuses for you. There's an hour-long interview with me on fibromyalgia. There's some cool sort of e-papers and guides that help you in your recovery in addition to the book. So just check it out at fibrofix.com.
Great. Thank you very much. So let's take a little break to identify our fabulous station here and let our engineer put something on that's nice, maybe some of our music and some IDs. And when we return, we're going to talk a little bit about maybe some treatments Dr. Brady can share with us about the typical management of fibromyalgia and how it's managed in medicine and certainly as a naturopathic doctor. Just give us some tidbits. Of course, you know, reading the book, it's a very complex treatment disorder, and really it really depends on how the patient presents the treatment, But we'll maybe talk a little bit about that. So stay tuned right here to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, it should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into The Natural Medicine Chest.
Our program again, and again you're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And with us is Dr. David M. Brady, and he is the author of The Fibrofix from Rodale, and also he's extremely popular presenter, academician, prolific author of medical papers, and even he currently serves as our vice provost for the Division of Health Sciences, where I'm also a teacher at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut in the College of Naturopathic Medicine. And we're very happy to have Dr. Brady, both as a champion of natural medicine, helping patients, and of course the naturopathic profession create really ripples and waves across the world to change healthcare. So welcome again, Dr. Brady.
Well, thank you, Dr. Z, and we're very happy to have you on our faculty and blessed to have you at the University of Bridgeport here. You're one of our gems.
Thank you, sir. Now, let's talk a little bit about, we've talked about what fibromyalgia is not. It's not sort of all these other things put together, a lot of these individual things which we cull out. But then once all these things are sort of ruled out, we have a person who still, like you said, has pain all over, everywhere in the body. They have a different perception of pain, which we can talk about what actually is pain. It's a great definition, you know, because pain, the way I remember, pain has to do with not only, you know, chemical messengers and things like that, but it's also our interpretation of the pain, and it's also our emotional attachment to the suffering as well that is extremely important. And that's where I think your cognitive medicine that you discuss in your book could be very instrumental in having people do things. I know when I have someone with real true fibromyalgia and I do hydrotherapy on them, and it gives them a little glimpse of relief from their pain, it usually changes their attitude from one of, oh, I'll never get better, to one where, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is a struggle, a life struggle, but there are going to be times when I'm up and times when I'm down. Because this is a chronic disorder, how do you counsel patients when you're in front of them, and how do you treat it differently?
Well, I think you have to, first of all, start by, you know, giving them hope. You can recover. It's going to be a bit of a journey. It's not going to be take this magic drug or take this magic herb or do this one magic practice and it's all going to go away immediately. It just doesn't work like that. But you need to give them hope and that they can recover, because they can. And I tell them that with confidence because I've seen it. But the patient has to really engage in that recovery. They do have to be patient. It's a step-by-step process, and it's a multifactorial process. It's not one thing. We have to really hit it from multiple sides. But like you gave that example of a patient in hydrotherapy, and, you know, classic hydrotherapy, old-school hydrotherapy that is a foundational principle of traditional naturopathic medicine is a practice where the patient, by definition, has to lay down. They have to sort of take some time to relax. They have to take some time that's dedicated to themselves and their own recovery. Keep in mind, most of these patients, by their sort of constitution or their very nature, are very, they're sort of fastidious. They tend to be very compulsive, like, you know, things have to be in their place, things have to be neat, things have to be orderly. That's just the way they tend to be wired, not all of them, but a lot of them. And they're very much caretakers. So they're always worried about everyone around them, all their loved ones, you know, making sure they're okay, really deathly afraid that something's going to happen to one of them. They're really always in that sort of protection mode. But they're really about facilitating everyone else, taking care of everyone else, and they very much neglect themselves. So the mere, you know, practice of doing something, taking some time away that's really dedicated to their own health and their own recovery, particularly something that emphasizes, you know, being relaxed and rejuvenating, that in and of itself is a very healing, therapeutic thing to do. And they need to get used to doing those kind of things on a routine basis, and it helps them see the light at the end of the tunnel. But you're right, we do have to deal with their biochemical reactions to pain. So we're changing neurotransmitters. We're elevating serotonin. We're getting them restful sleep by changing neurotransmitters, which increases their growth hormone, which lowers their substance P, which modulates how they perceive pain, and they can tolerate more things before it's registered as pain. But we're also dealing with the psychological side, with calming the mind through these different, you know, practices, if you will, or these cognitive behavioral therapies. And oftentimes, if they have sort of one of these difficult histories like I talked about, we also work with teams of, you know, psychologists, basically, and counselors who can kind of work people through some of that stuff as well. So all put together in a plan with a little bit of patience and changing the diet, making them less inflammatory, getting them off things that activate their innate immune response or their inflammatory pathways and their immune upregulation, you know, we can really make a lot of headway in the vast majority of these patients. It's just not a, you know, quick magic bullet fix kind of scenario. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen with any of the medications. In fact, the, you know, the three approved drugs for fibromyalgia, of the three, Two of them are selective serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, so they're basically repurposed, recycled antidepressant medications. One of them is alpha-2-delta ligand, which is basically a recycled, repurposed anti-epileptic medication, which just dumbs down the nervous system. So even in those properly diagnosed with classic fibromyalgia, in which these type of drug agents may have some chance of helping their symptoms, they have a lot of side effects. You know, they tend to make you groggy, not clear of thought, which is, you know, often the last thing someone who already has fatigue and cognitive issues needs. But the studies are quite clear. There was a very large study done by Rand that looked at responsiveness to these fibromyalgia medications, and basically less than 25%, I believe it was 22%, had any, you know, a significantly, statistically significant improvement in their functionality. And most of those over time, the positive benefit diminished over several months to where they ended up after several months, even with an initial benefit, they were back where they were to begin with, but now they had the added side effects of the medication. So the medications can be helpful in some people, and we use them sometimes if they're properly selected, but by no means are the drug options a fix or a cure or even a high probability of helping someone who actually has classic fibromyalgia, unfortunately.
Now, what about the non-restorative sleep piece? I know, I remember reading something that you could pretty much induce muscle pain in anyone, whether they have a pain processing disorder or not, by depriving them of sleep. And that seems to be one of the biggest challenges that I've seen in
dealing
with patients.
You know, you can't get much by on you, Dr. Z. You're really up on the literature, but you're right. That was, those studies have been done by multiple groups, but the original work was done by Harvey Moldovsky at the University of Toronto. And back even into the late 70s, he was the first person to really correlate this specific type of sleep dysfunction, which we call non-REM delta wave sleep dysfunction or alpha wave intrusion in delta wave sleep. So you never go into the delta wave restorative sleep. So these patients sleep. You know, once they get to sleep, they can sleep for 14 hours, but they never go into the stage of sleep that really restores them. So they wake up feeling like they never slept, essentially. And this, the level of sleep dysfunction has been correlated with their level of pain on their level of achiness. But you're right. They've taken actually normal people, normal subjects, and they've deprived them, artificially, you know, deprived them of sleep. They've either done this with introducing some sort of noxious stimuli, either a little electrical pulse into their muscles. Sometimes it's with noise stimulus. But they, what they do is they deprive them from going into delta wave restorative sleep or slow wave sleep. They don't wake them up. They just change their sleep. They wake them up kind of, you know what I mean? But they don't fully wake them up to where now they're conscious and interacting with anybody. But if they push them out of this restorative sleep, even young, vibrant individuals, they did it with college students who were very healthy.
Yeah.
If they did it long enough, these subjects developed hyperalgesia or even allodynia, which means they had achiness all over the body. So you can induce this allodynia or these changes of pain perception simply by causing sleep dysfunction. So addressing sleep dysfunction is one of the primary things we do. And we do that with proper sleep hygiene, getting people to sleep, you know, predictably. They go to bed every night at the same time. They get up every morning at the same time, regardless whether it's weekend or weekday. They respect light-dark cycles. So they're basically trying to be up and out in bright sunlight in the midday and in noon and in the morning. But at nighttime, they're not getting a lot of exposure to bright blue wave light. So, but that's hard today because of all the, you know, artificial light and the light pollution and all these new energy efficient LED bulbs and these more efficient, you know, curly Q lamps have more of that shortwave blue and violet spectrum light that tells the brain that it's noon and not to make melatonin and not to go to sleep. And some of the biggest offenders are all the devices that we keep very close to our face. So iPads, laptops, iPhones, they're putting out tons of blue light. People are on these all the way until when they're trying to go to bed. They're overstimulating themselves. They do not make melatonin. Therefore, they have no hope of getting to sleep. That's why insomnia is so rampant. And if they do get to sleep, they don't go into the deep stages of sleep. So we get them off the devices after 7 or 8 o'clock at night. If they must be on them, we install software on them that pulls out the blue light out of the monitor, and they look more orange as the day gets later. You can download these apps for your iPhone or for your iPad. Just go on and search blue blocking app or light blocking applications. You can install them. They're very inexpensive onto your devices. We make sure that their room is dark, quiet, no pets in the bed. They don't do things in the bedroom other than sleep. And one other thing, you can guess what that is, Dr. Z. Otherwise, don't be in the bedroom. You're not in the bedroom watching TV. You're not in the bedroom doing other things. You're training your brain when you're in the bedroom that you're not going to be asleep. So sleep hygiene, we'll even have people in their rooms that they're going to spend the evenings in use, there's bulbs you can buy that are deficient in blue spectrum light. They look, you know, looks like kind of normal light, but it doesn't have that frequency in it. Their night lights have to be like that. Red night lights are fine. And sometimes we'll even use amber, these sort of yellow lens glasses they put on at night. They're blue blocking lenses, basically. It works very well.
I look forward to a lot of my patients reading your book and listening to the FibroFix Summit because that's one of the biggest obstacles to cure.
Well, that's good, Dr. Z, because it's meant for healthcare providers to be able to read it and learn a lot, but it's really meant for them to be able to recommend that patients who they think may have fibromyalgia to read it so they have a much greater understanding of what you're trying to accomplish with them as a provider.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's good. Now, I find that some folks are toxic, and I know you have like a three-part, I'm trying to think of the right word, but basically a almost like a formula in a way of, and the first part I know you talked about is detoxification, and then the other two parts were...
Yeah, that's the entry. Like, there's like the book tries to do a couple of things. One is when you first start reading it, it's trying to jumpstart recovery, and there's a 21-day foundational sort of, program. And part of that involves a metabolic reset. And it's a metabolic detoxification. And it's not because that's a cure for fibromyalgia. It's because if you can get someone's metabolism rebooted, right, you can give them things that are good for energy production while you're taking the inflammatory, very allergenic sensitivity, inflammatory-producing foods out of their diet, at least for a while you're giving them things that will promote detoxification, removal of toxins that can interfere with energy production, then you get the person feeling a lot better very quickly, regardless of what they have. It really doesn't matter at that point whether they truly have fibromyalgia or something that's been inappropriately called fibromyalgia. So by going through this detox program, while you're also following this program that starts introducing movement and motion and flexibility and also these relaxation practices. We cover, progressive relaxation, guided imagery, and things to start calming the mind, moving the body, detoxifying, cleaning up the diet over this 21-day period while you're reading the book and trying to determine, do I really have classic fibromyalgia, or do I have one of these other things? And we break those other things up into what we call buckets. So do I have a structural musculoskeletal problem? Do I have maybe a medical condition or multiple medical conditions that can be causing my problems? Do I have a functional issue like a mitochondrial energy problem, a subtle thyroid issue? And then we go on to give very deep, very detailed roadmaps on things to do to recover based on where you landed in those different buckets or whether you have classic fibromyalgia. And we do that with different questionnaires, different gateways in the book. But then it gives very specific guidelines and very easy to follow, empowering information to help you in your recovery.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I found that the amino acid SAMe is needed to convert the serotonin to the melatonin, but then if you're toxic, you're going to be stealing the methionine, which makes up the SAMe,
help
to the detox pathways. And so that's why detoxification can help sleep. And
sure,
it's been
absolutely miraculous
in some patients.
It's just toxins can get in the way of conversion of thyroid hormones. They can sabotage mitochondrial enzymes that produce energy. Things like, for instance, vitamin D talks to the genes, which creates the enzyme, which converts tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan, more specifically, to serotonin. So vitamin D has been used in pain for a long time, and now we're understanding why it's probably working.
Wow, great. Well, we only have a few more minutes, Dr. Brady.
Yeah.
Do you have any last-minute thoughts of, again, where people could learn more about you, your book, The FibroFix, and the FibroFix Summit again?
Yeah, you know, people can learn just more about me generally in my practice and things like that, and really get a lot of free articles and see previous interviews and all kinds of neat stuff on me at just drdavidbrady.com. That's my main website, drdavidbrady, drdavidbrady.com. But specific to the book itself, it's fibrofix.com, fibrofix.com. You can also get there from drdavidbrady.com. And the book site has, you know, ways to purchase the book and get 40% off the cover price before it releases, actually. And then it unlocks a bunch of bonus gifts for you. And then with the summit, and I really love people to join us on the summit, the FibroFix Summit, they can just go to FibroFixSummit.com and register. And they'll start pushing you information on when the summit will be and how to participate in it.
Great. Thanks so much for elucidating this very mysterious disorder and for your work and perseverance in helping people recover from this thing. I think part of it is knowledge. Knowledge is power, getting rid of the ignorance that, and for no one's fault, but just the ignorance around this thing and realizing that it is a distinct entity and just helping us navigate. Appreciate it.
Okay, well, I appreciate you letting me be on and spread the word, and it's a big mission of mine to get this information out to all the folks who need it, and thank you, and thank Dr. Cammie as well.
Yeah, and that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z signing out, hoping that you stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.